The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 23rd of June 2020. I'm sitting here with Rena Pascoe Walkerville. Thank you very much, Rena, for agreeing to participate in this program, The RSL Time to Celebrate. Could I ask you, please, just to state your full name, your date of birth, and your service number, please?
My name is Rena June Pascoe. My date of birth was May the 12th, 1921.
And your service number?
My service number is 51859.
I'd like to start off, could you share a little bit of information about where you were born and where you grew up as a child, a bit about your early family childhood?
Yes. I was born at Yorktown in the congregational manse. There was no room at the hospital, so I was born at the manse. It was a difficult birth, so the lady that had me there had to call my father in to help, and I believe he may have been the first man to help in the birth of a baby, because in those days men were always shut away from those things. So I started being Dad's spoilt little baby. I remember growing up on the farm at Edithburg until I was 7, I think, years old. What I can remember of that, that was, I feel, was something worthwhile, as my father was the first person there to get a radio set, which was built with valves and two batteries, a dry cell and another one. And people from other farms used to come round to listen to this wonderful thing, this radio. And also he and another man were the first ones to get two brand new Model T Fords. And I remember when he brought that home, I ran out to meet him. I must have been about 3 or 4. And he put me up in the seat behind the driving wheel, and I thought I was driving Dad's new car. I don't remember very much more of then, because I started school when I was 5. And rather funny, my teacher became Lady Scott. She married a man with a title and she became Lady Scott. And at the end of that year, Dad decided to sell the farm and go to a bigger farm, which was, he thought, over on Eyres Peninsula. The reason why I did that was because my second brother was born. I had one 4.5 years older and Les was 5.5 years younger. And in those days, the men stayed on the farms with their father, and he felt this one was not big enough for 3 men. So he sold it to go to a bigger farm. It was virgin country, which he took. It was north of Woodner, quite a few. Well, we measured it by sandhills, not miles. We had 5 sandhills to get over, which were not made roads. So you always got stuck on one going out and coming home, everybody out pushing. And of course, being virgin country, we didn't have anything around us. We had no electricity. Water was only what we could catch in the 4 tanks that were 2 on the one shed for the implement shed and 2 on the house shed. And at that stage, though, we had an 8.5 inch rainfall. So we talked about the day it rained, and we'd get perhaps 2 inches in the one downfall and fill up the tanks. And we were on water rations all the time that we were there. Electricity, people say to me, how did you keep your butter? And I said, we didn't keep our butter firm. You poured it on like olive oil. And it really was, looked like olive oil. As kids, we couldn't have jellies or anything like that because it was too hot to set. And wintertime, we had what most kids have, summertime. Because in the wintertime, it was very cold in the mornings, and come out about 10 o'clock, it would come warm and for the rest of the day until it started the sun go down again. In wintertime, everything that was fluid became solid ice overnight. And because we had to watch water rationing, the men had a bowl outside on a box with about 2 inches of water, and that had to be all day. They washed their face in the morning with it and then washed their hands in it when they came in to eat, and the same at night. But that was left there at night and it froze. In the morning, it was thawed out and put on the garden, because that's the only water we had, was bath water or something like that. A lot of things we couldn't grow. I remember Mum used to grow cabbages that were huge. They lasted for a week. Kids didn't like cabbage. And when we first went there, he rolled down about 200 acres of scrub, which they had like a big boiler thing from, and they pulled it along with the tractor and that rolled the trees down. Then they had to be chopped up and put into heaps and burnt. It was a big job, so Dad hired five Greek men who were just trying to get enough money to bring their wives out here. And he hired these five Greek men, and they used to get up with a lantern in the morning to get out to the paddock, so that as soon as it had daylight, they'd start picking the sticks and stumps and putting them in the heaps and burning them. And at night time, they worked till they couldn't see and came home with the lanterns. And they got 5 shillings a day for doing that. One off, they camped at down, just down from the house a little bit. They camped in tents and they had a cook. And one day Dad was going down to Woodnet to get some supplies, and he'd asked them what if they wanted anything. And the man who seemed to be in charge, he said, "I want this, that, thing, and potatoes, so on, but I want 3 pounds of pins." And my father said, "What do you want, pins?" "Yes, I want 3 pounds of pins." Dad tried to work out what he meant. And he said, "Show me what you do when you get these pins." "Oh, you tap the top off, you put that, and then you cut them." "Beans." It turned out to be beans, not pins. And so there's lots of funny little things used to happen. The horses, Dad had horses. He had to cart water once or 2 weeks, I think every 2 weeks they'd have a big tank on the back of the truck, and they'd go down about 7 or 8 miles where the government water came. And like you see on trains, they come up with a thing with a thing hanging down, so that when they was like that, so they backed their truck tank under that and filled the tank. And they used to do that all day. One man would be doing that all day, filling that up, coming back, putting it into the tanks, and then going back for more. And that kept the horses going. But even the horses, they always had water in their troughs, but they were not allowed to flush it out or anything, because they were on water rations the same as we were. And that was a very, very interesting time, because we were too far away from the school. So my brother, older brother, and myself had correspondence school. Till my brother reached 13, he thought he was a man, so he was allowed to go out and join the men, working men. And during that time, I think I was in year 5 or 4, I'm not sure which, we used to get a lot of dry thunderstorms. And one day I was sitting at the table doing my schoolwork, and my mother was down the other end, was folding her clothes. In those days, they damped clothes down after they'd dried and rolled them up, you know, to iron them. She was down that end, I was up this end. with my back to our piano, which was big iron frame piano, took 5 men to shift it. Next to that was the radio, and the thunder lightning struck the aerial, which used to be a long 60 feet of aerial, and the lightning apparently struck that, and it ran along that and down the cord. The cord was had fabric around it in those days, and it burnt all the fabric down there, and it blew the front out of the radio, because the radio was, you know, sort of like that, blew the front out of that. And then it jumped to the piano and to me. And I just remember seeing a big red light on my book when I was doing the schoolwork. And it sort of gradually went out. And it was me that went out. And Mum was there, and she said it spun her around. Well, she was then spun her around. My brother, my big brother and my little brother were in their bedroom next to it, because it was a hot day, and in those days the only air conditioning was you come home and you lie on the lino. And Jim was there, and Les was only still in his cot, about 3. And Jim said, we didn't have ceilings, and Jim said when it struck, the whole of the roof lit up, and they weren't hurt, but because they just saw that. But my father and used to come in. When it got too hot, he would bring the horses and the men. Didn't work between 10 and 2 because that was the hottest part of the day. And they were sitting out in the kitchen, and the explosion was so loud that Dad reacted, jumped under the table, and wartime reaction. And he said the whole room filled up with smoke. And of course, I came round and came round with him asking if I was all right. But they took me down to the doctor a couple of days later because my ears were so sore that I couldn't even have my hair on. I had to have my hair pinned back, and people walking across silently on the floor sounded like and hurting each time they did that. But the doctor said that had my piano not been an iron frame, I would have been killed. But the piano took, because it was iron frame, that took the biggest part of the shock. It blew the side out, and the veneer part was all scorched off, you know. But that saved my life.
Wow. And is that very vivid in your mind? Do you remember that?
Very vivid, because every time I hear thunder, I get scared. Wow. As my father said, if you hear the thunder, you know you're safe, because that comes after the strike. But even now, if I hear them saying there's likely to be a thunderstorm, I get worried. And when we do have thunder over, I'm like a little kid, I'm under the blankets or make sure there's nothing turned on to bring it in. So that has stayed with me all my life, because we still have thunder, I feel that it's continuing on. People say lightning never strikes twice in the same place, but I said, I'm not in the same place. that is more vivid. How can I put that? That has stayed with me. When other things, I just think back sometimes, but that has stayed with me every time we get a threat of a thunderstorm or we get a thunderstorm.
And just to double check, what age were you when this happened?
Pardon?
What age were you when this happened?
I think it might have been year 4 or 5, so been 9 perhaps, because I started school when I was 5, okay. 5, 6.
So it's approximately 90 years ago.
Yes, yes.
This experience.
Yes, and it's still with me. It will be till the last. I don't want to go out with a thunder's clap. Another thing that happened, as Dad got... the depression started then, and all I can remember about the depression is my father saying, now I have wheat to sell, there's nobody with money that to buy it, because it took a couple of years before he could get wheat, you know. But actually the only part of the depression that we felt because was, well, I didn't know there was such a thing as a depression. because we had plenty to eat. We had chickens, brought up on chickens. We used to have big roosters that would do, you know, three families if they were visiting us. We had more eggs than that we could do. And we had our cows, where we had plenty of milk, plenty of cream, plenty of homemade butter. And Dad used to send some wheat down to Port Lincoln, they'd get gristed into flour. And so we had plenty of flour, so Mum used to make bread twice a week, five loaves at a time to keep us going, because couldn't go down for bread. She was a plain cook, she was a city girl, but I often wonder how she stuck out the farm, because she made beautiful, what they used to call blow-away sponges, they were raised, and she just had a fork to beat the eggs with, and a stove she'd put her hand in the oven and feel whether it was hot enough. If it was too hot, she'd put some of the ashes away. If it wasn't hot enough, she'd bring them up. And she what she cooked was absolutely beautiful. I've tried her recipe for scones, and they turn out rock cakes. and all done with, I do it with modern utensils and can't make it edible. And Mum did it with a fork. So much so that the fork was, we've still got it. It's that part of the fork where she's brought, is worn down. We had our supplies came from Adelaide every 3 months and come from, go over to Port Lincoln and then up to Pygerie, well, by rail, and Dad would have to go down there and get it from the siding. And when it came back, then it was all hands on deck to get it all unloaded and put inside. And I can remember everybody feeling happy when all of the cupboards were full. And we had bully beef, camp pie, and all the things they tell you will kill you. Well, they're things that we were brought up on. And our fish came out of tins. Once a year after the harvest, all the farmers used to go down to Venus Bay. In those days, it was just a tent city. There was no, you know, it was just a bay and lots of big sand hills. And as they filled the thing up with these shacks, and now the sand hills have drifted into the bay and filling the bay up. Last time I was over there was 15 years ago. And at the end of the jetty, this end of the jetty, not the sea end, there was steps, and a big step down there that I used to dive off, and that was under sand the last time I saw it. The bay is filling right up. Where we used to camp, and the water was not far away, there's now bushes and things grown that, between there. So all these big sand hills had filled it all up.
How did it feel going back to places like this and seeing the change?
Well,
so much change.
It has. I mean, sometimes even now I think, oh, I'd love to go back there. And I think what it would be now to what I'm thinking about, so different. No connection, really. I mean, even that old home we went to see that, and the corner had fallen out of it, you know. And I think, I'd love to go back, you know, all those years with Mum and Dad. And then I think that little pepper tree would be a big tree if it's still there. Corner of her bedroom had fallen out. There was nothing there that was just ruins. Mm-hmm. And so I feel there's no connection with where I grew up and where it is now, because there's nobody living there. They work it, but I have had other farms, and you know, and they've got so much water over there now that they can keep sheep, so they couldn't in those days. And it's like another world when you think about it, and you see these things, or a story that you read. Mm-hmm. You know. And but they were wonderful days. My father and mother never ever argued. I think my mother must have been a bit soft, because she agreed with everything Dad suggested. But of course, we played on that, because we'd say, can we do such and such a thing, Mum? She'd say, well, ask your father. So we'd go to Dad and say, Dad, can we do anything? Mum said we could if you say. So we said, well, if your Mum said you did, okay. that would have been a lolly out of a tin as we'd got or something. And I think afterwards, we're as bad as the little kids now. I mean, in a different way. But my not having any sisters, my companions were the foals, mainly the foals and the horses and the cows. And I used to go down one big black horse we had. He was Duke, and they were these big working horses like Clydesdales, you know. And he was pure black. And I used to go and put my arms around his neck, and he used to move his head up and down for me to swing. I never told Mum about this because I knew it would be too dangerous, you know. And one day my hand slipped and I fell down in front of him, and I looked up. He was standing still. I'll swear he was smiling. He wasn't showing his teeth in anger. He was just looking at me, and his teeth were all showing as he was smiling. So horses do see funny things. It's funny, we had another horse there. He was peculiar. If he wanted to chase another horse, he'd find something, a piece of broom bush or stick or something, and chase them with it. He never chased another horse unless he had something in his mouth, a piece of wood to chase them. We got a lot of fun out of those things, you know. That was our life. And another thing I was thinking of the other day, we had these trapdoor spiders. Do you know them? Mm. And they used to, they'd hole down and line the thing with their silk, you know, look bit, and then this little door they'd put on. The door was just a piece of dirt with a lining of web underneath, and we'd come across and we'd open the thing and put a piece of straw down there, and out come all the tiny little baby spiders, throw them over. Then we'd stand back until the spider would come up and see that everything was clear, so all the little spiders would go back, and she'd go over, and love to see, she'd always put one of the claws up and pull the trapdoor down after him. We had lots of fun with, they were our, the animals around was like going to the zoo. We had plenty of emus, plenty of kangaroos, foxes, rabbits, birds.
Snakes as well.
Oh, snakes, that was the only problem. But we had mainly the big snakes kept out of the way. They didn't come inside or anything. They'd probably don't be down the back part. I was taking my little brother out to take morning tea out to the boys on the harvester, and walking across the crop where they had already harvested. And my brother's little fox terrier, he all of a sudden he jumped on Les and threw him back and picked up a snake and whipped it. Les would have stood right on it. And that little Nippy was a fox terrier. He was good. The only thing about him, he was so protective to Les. If Les was doing something, and Mum would sing out, you know, don't stop doing that or don't do that. And Les used to put his little nose against the window, kitchen window, and the worst swear word he could think of was poop. So he used to stand there and say, poop, poop, poop. And Mum would sing out, I'll come out and give you a hiding. And he'd say, Nip, Nip. Make sure Nip was there, because nobody could touch him when Nip was there. But
very protective dog.
He was a beautiful dog, and he was a fox terrier. And he lived to a ripe old age. I used to milk 3 cows night and morning. And I had to get up in the morning, and they were always in the cow paddock just down near their shed in the morning. That was all right, but during the day they used to go right across to where they could get feed over Sandhill and over into what we called the 200 acre paddock. And I had to walk out there to get them at night. So I'd walk over and get up to the top of the Sandhill and just call them, and they'd look up and see me, and they'd come across and go into their little track they'd made right through. We had one old horse that he had been retired. King Billy he was called. And so Dad wouldn't shoot him. He said he earned his living and wouldn't shoot him or anything. So he used to go with the cows. He thought he was a cow. And he followed the cows out and in. And he got so tired, you get the cows, we'd be halfway back to the house and there's King Billy sound asleep. On the way back, he'd go to sleep coming back. Oh, we did have some lovely times over there, but we used to come. Dad used to come over every couple of years. It used to take us 3 days to get across here from there. Now they do it in one day. And they always came across in the truck so that he could pick up wire or anything that he needed to take back to the farm. And what was I going to say? We'd sit in the, Les and I'd sit in the back. We'd leave Jim home by that time to look after the farm. And come across to for Mum to see her mother and father. So that was okay. So I only saw my grandma and grandpa every 2 to 3 years. So I was never close to them. They were from Scotland, and I never saw enough of them to get used to their accent, so I never knew what Grandpa was saying. If we were playing in the backyard, Grandpa came out and said something. If he was smiling, was okay, we knew that he'd made some girdled scones. If he came out and wasn't smiling, we stopped doing what we were doing because we didn't know what. He died when I was 13 or 14, but I never ever understood what my grandfather said. Could never understand it. Grandma, she was from Rutherglen. Grandpa was from Edinburgh. And Grandma was more highly educated because her grandmother was a titled lady. And she was educated at the big house, she used to say, up at the big house. And so she was educated and brought up differently. She had just the nice Scottish accent that we could understand. Except a few of the words she used to keep on with. You know, going to Kirk on Sundays, putting your breeks on, put a clean pair of breeks on, and, you know, a few things like that. And my mother always was a wee, was never little, it was always a wee thing. didn't have little cows, we had wee cows and so on. That's the only word that she sort of picked up and never ever sort of got over it.
Was your mother born in Australia?
My mother was born here. Her older brothers and sisters were born in Scotland. And then Grandpa came out here, and Mum and a brother were born out here. I always said it was because Grandpa was too mean to pay the freight out. So, and her younger brother was William Wallace, and he was killed at the landing of Gallipoli just 3 weeks after he turned 19. So that was the end of the William Wallaces from the direct line down there. But as I said, I've got close to my granddaughters because I was never close to my grandma, and I always wished I had. But as I got a bit older, and she used to like to talk to me about her life as a young girl and going to the Castle of Milk and all this sort of thing. She knew old Queen, what was her name, old Queen Mary. They were sort of children together, and Queen Mary, and she used to go to the Castle of Milk for holidays and so on. And when she came out here, of course, that kind of life stopped out here. Although she used to go, I don't know how, but she used to go to Government House quite a bit because she did the Highland Fling at Government House when she was 60 years old, and they gave her a big doll dressed in the tartan of the Graham tartan. And I was at Government House a couple of years ago, and I mentioned this to the governor, and he said, well, when your grandmother used to come here, this wouldn't have been the front door, this would have been the front door. And he took me out to the side door, which faces that road that goes down from North Terrace down there. And that used to be the front door. And he said, this is where your grandmother would have been coming in and out, there. But, I think that's about all that was interesting in my life before the war.
Wow, that's amazing. So, being out there on the land, obviously you worked hard every day, and to entertain yourselves, you mentioned the animals. What else would you do to kind of entertain yourselves out there?
Mum and Dad used to believe in mixing with being a parent. So at night time we always had snakes and ladders, board games to play. There was always a big fire on in the winter time. We put big stumps like this size that burn all day and all night, you know. So the place was always warm. Our family room would, what we called then, was dining room. It was just our dining room plus some couple of big chairs, you know. And so there was always, we were never, I didn't know what loneliness was, except sometimes I wish I had a sister that could, I could talk to about clothes, you know, whether I was wearing the right thing. And Mum used to say, of course you are, it doesn't matter what you're wearing the right thing. In those days you didn't have many clothes. I had a white dress, a white silk dress with fancy hand working on the collar. I don't know what it was, but to me they looked like sausages, and I always called that my sausage dress. That was for going to Sunday school or church in. And you only had one dress. You put that on, you went, when you got home, you changed straight into your old dress, you know. Old dresses on the farm were made out of Mum's, the skirts of Mum's dresses, because they wore sort of straight down, not much shape in their dresses. So when the top part started to wear, the bottom part was still good, and there was enough there to make dresses for me for around home. But I keep thinking of how Mum and Dad, we grew up thinking, okay, you grow up, you get married and you live happily ever afterwards, like they did. Get a shock when you find out it's not all the same. I never ever heard them raise their voice to each other. They talked all the time to each other. Anything Dad thought about, he'd talk up to Mum, and Mum would sort of look as though she's taking interest in it anyway. At night time, when we got older and the boys left, you'd hear them, one reading a bit to the other one or discussing what they've just read. And I thought that was what marriage was. Maybe it is when you're alone way out in the scrub. But my father was very religious, and I think that he believed, he used to say, don't preach anything you don't practice. He was an old Methodist, which they were very tight in those days. You weren't allowed to have cards in the house, because that led to gambling. Never had any alcohol, because that led to alcoholism. You didn't go dancing in those days, because that's too close to a man. Was very, very strict. But Dad never ever told us what to do. He would say, now, if that was me, I would be doing so-and-so, but you've got to make up your own mind. And, of course, you always wanted to please Dad, so you did what Dad wanted to. And grew up that way, that we'd never do anything that we thought would hurt Dad. And because I took up dancing when we came over here after the war. I liked dancing. Even though men were close to you, I didn't get infected by them. Wartime was a different life altogether. Because I had not mixed a lot with other people, certainly not with women, I found it a bit difficult to get used to having showers with others, having showers at the same time when you didn't have a division between your showers. Just to me, they're all a whole lot of raw bodies, which were wicked, you know. Got used to it after a while. The first night that we went down to Victor Harbour, we were the first girls down at Victor Harbour, went to the toilet, about 10 toilets along there and 10 toilets along the front of you, with no nothing in between. You just sat down on a toilet next to a strange girl sitting on the toilet, you know. did get used to it after a while, but that was the introduction to me of mixing with other women. The first shower I had, I dropped my soap and I bent down to pick it up, and as I stood up, my bottom went against the girl's bottom that side, and that sort of put me off a bit. Not having sisters, it was, you know, it, a dreadful thing happened to me. There we all had lots of injections, you know, we lined up and they gave the injections. At least the girls waited till they had the injections before they fainted. The men used to faint waiting to go in. But one night, or the first night actually after the injection, it played on my bladder. And in the middle of the night I had to get up. I was down this end, there was 28 of us in the hut. And so I was right down this end. We had to come right out the front, cross over a little lawn patch, go through a little section of big gum trees, and the latrines were right over there. Take 3 minutes to get there. And I couldn't make it. I got to the gum trees, and I can't do anything else. So I squatted. First thing I did, "Halt, who goes there?" I sang out, "Friend," and I couldn't stop. I was moving around the tree and the light was coming around it, saying, what was the step forward and be recognised. And he realised what was going on. He said, "Pass, friend." But that was terribly embarrassing. And this all happened within a couple of days of going in, mixing with all this crowd. And I can still feel the embarrassment of that. But after that we went, I was posted to Malala, which was our operational and training site there. And I was a fabric worker, and that included the planes were covered in mercerised cotton in those days, and you had to stitch them on, then you put dope on them, which shrank them and made them tight. And so we were doing that, and they asked me if I'd like to do camouflage, which I said yes, that'll be a bit different. So I was sent to a hangar, a very large hangar, where they were doing the camouflaging on one side and the mechanics were working on the motors on that side, and they were revving these engines up all the time. And of course we didn't know anything about earmuffs, and I've got two hearing aids. As I've got older they've got worse, but they were from the revving of the engines. I liked that until one day I was training a new boy, and up on the, for the nose of the plane, and you know, I used to be slanted like that. And he was standing on a 44-gallon drum, and he was holding the spray gun in his hand. And I was saying to him, "Don't go straight across, you've got to, you know, do it like this." And he hadn't gripped it properly, and it fell, hit the drum. And I had my mouth open when it sprayed, and I swallowed and got a bit in my eyes. And acetone, which burnt my stomach, so I was put in hospital for a couple of weeks, living on malt extract, nothing else but malt extract that was supposed to heal his stomach. So anyway, when I got over that, they said, do you want to go back there? And I said, yes, definitely, because I liked knowing that I had camouflaged the planes that were being used for night and day surveillance. Underneath a pale blue for day surveillance and black at night, which was horrible. We had to wear masks for that. And one of the planes that I camouflaged was the one that spotted the sub that was coming up. And so that was all planes scattered around, all bombed up, ready to go, and the thing turned around. I think they realised if they went up into their harbour, there's no way for them to get out. So they turned around and left. So we didn't. The planes that I camouflaged did not drop bombs. The bombs were all taken off and put away again.
Sorry, that sub came up the Gulf?
Yes, it was coming up, yeah, quite close, because they got all ready to bomb it. And I think they were waiting for it to get to a certain stage when they would take off. And it turned around. And so we just debombed and took all the bombs off and put them back in the arsenal. But so anyway, I went back doing that, and I started to get funny feelings, sickish and cold and so on, and they decided I'd become allergic to the acetone, which we use for thinners, all the, you know. And so they took me away from that, and while they were deciding what to do with me, I went over to the armoury section and learned how to fill the cans with the bullets for the automatic. In those days they didn't have them in the thing, they had them in round tins, and not like they have nowadays. So you'd have to fill all those. I did that, and that's when they said, come on, we're doing rifle practice today. Okay. Nobody told me to 303 quick kicks. I just held it up my shoulder and pulled the trigger, and it really kicked. And then I did that for a while, and finally they decided that maybe they'd put me into signals on the telephones. So I did the telephones then. So I got shifted around after that. Went to 4SDT and 14 stores, and then finally I was lent to the last 6 months of the war. I was lent to the 300 group at RAF in Victoria. That was a transport group from England. And so the first night there, my telephone was right next door to the the rec room. And I thought I'd landed in a foreign land there with men from all walks of life around England and Scotland and Ireland with all the different accents. I thought, oh, I thought I'd been landed in Italy or somewhere. It took a while. But they were good. The CO there was an Earl, and somehow the house must have been built and then something added to it, because I had a window that they could lift up, but there were steps that went past to go down somehow. And the Earl, every night as he went, knocked off a bit earlier than I did, and he'd go down there and he'd lift up the window and say, good night, girly. And and once I met him on the stairs, and I stood back because they were corkscrew stairs, and I stood back to let the officer go by, and he said, ladies first. I thought, gee, I should have joined the RAF instead of the RAAF, because we had an officer like that, you stand still and let them go past. But that was quite a nice 6 months I spent there, and ended up there with appendicitis. And they sent me up to a hospital. I can't think of the name of it now. Same name as what there is over in Germany. Anyway, in those days it took you 2 weeks to get your appendix out. And it came through while I was in there that to go to rehab at Bright. I've forgotten now. To a Red Cross rehab place, and to get there before, and my discharge came through while I was there. But I was also invited with the group at the rehab to go to Government House, Victoria, Melbourne. It was just a thank you thing from the government, I think. And I wasn't sure whether I had to salute the governor when he came over, so I kept up. When I saw him coming my way, I disappeared, came the other way. So I spent the afternoon dodging the governor.
What year was this now?
This was 1945. And that was in November 1945. And for the next 6 months, I suffered from the same as what a lot of the men did. We'd been so much under discipline that just couldn't go for a job. Just wanted to stay home all the time. But some of the people that had had a different life before they went in, they were all right. But because I was so sheltered before, I never did anything wrong in the Air Force because I had to do everything, you know, I kept doing everything the right way. And so that when I was discharged, I just wanted to sit home with Mum and Dad all the time. And it was 6 months before I could bring myself to ring up for a job. I couldn't face them. I felt as though I couldn't face them, so I rang. You could go and see them all. There was a Balfour's that used to be in King William Street. And so I rang, and they said to come up and see, talk to them. And went. So I thought, oh, well, now they know about me, I'll be all right. So I went up there. And because I was ex-service, they automatically gave me the job. So I was a telephone operator there for a little while. Then I went nursing. Then I got married.
Do you remember the end of the war? Do you remember your feelings, your thoughts, perspectives on what was happening and taking place?
Well, because I was on the switchboard on duty, when Germany gave in, I just heard, you know, they got officers and all that stupid, they'll ring you up and pouring beer down the phone for you and all this sort of thing. And so the celebrations, I was on duty when everybody else was there. And then, of course, when the Japs gave in, it was the same thing. And I was at I was in Southern Area when the Germans gave in, and I was with the RAF when the Japs gave in, so their celebration was different as well. And but I was on duty when everybody else was enjoying themselves.
Celebrating.
Yeah. I know back here, my mum and dad and auntie, they found things I had made of flags, shape with WAF on it and all that, and they put them all up on their car and went into town, and there was apparently hundreds of people there who helped themselves to all the things off the car, so all my things went. But I wasn't excited when the war ended. I mean, we used to look forward to the end of the war, but when it did, I wasn't excited because I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I felt helpless, as though I'd been thrown out of something and that was it, you know. I just couldn't bring myself to go out. Mum used to say, why don't you meet some of your friends and go into Balfour's and have something to eat? I'd go in there with Mum, but I wouldn't go on my own or with anybody else. I was completely under discipline that I couldn't get out of, you know. I said if I'd had a daughter, I would have trained her differently. I think mixing with growing up, the part that where you mix and grow your character, I didn't have anybody except my mother to look to, you know. And my mum was a bit strict. She didn't talk about anything that young growing women should know about. She wouldn't talk about anything like that. When that happened, I thought I was dying. And you didn't. I mean, nowadays, everything's out in the open, but I mean, I thought when a man and a woman slept together, they got a baby. So I thought my parents only slept together 3 times. And nobody told me any different. And I didn't ask because we were brought up not to talk about things like that. And so I made sure that my son, when he was 3 years old, the cat was having kittens, so I made sure he saw them. Since I lived here, which was 35, 36 years, I think, this year, I joined the RSL when they allowed us to. The RSL wouldn't have women joining them for a long time.
And what year was that?
I can't remember, about 30 years ago, I think, was, yeah. And as soon as they were allowed to, actually there was a man from the RSL that lived here and I lived up the top. And he was secretary and also president down there. And he told me when I could, you know, join, he said, why don't you join up? So I said yes, I went down there and paid my money, got the cold shoulder from all of the wives because I was didn't have a partner. And so I didn't go for a good while, and then somebody else came on. I was the president, that's president now, but he was president of a long time ago. And he was president and he said, why don't you come down and have a meal? So I went down there, and the women were all sitting in one section and one side of the thing. The men were all sitting that side, a few tables down the middle. So I went down, I looked, I wasn't invited anywhere, so I went straight down to the kitchen. I got my meal, and I walked, I didn't know where, so I walked to the nearest table and sat down and started eating. And at that time is when the men decided to go and get, and apparently I was sitting at a table where a lot of men always sit, so they still came and sat, and I was sitting at one end, and they were all sitting there and talking, and I was getting daggers from looks from their wives sitting the other side. They did not like single girls. I think their marriages must have been so insecure that they were frightened. So anyway, I never went back again for a long time. And then I got in touch with the Vietnam veterans who used the Walkerville Hall before the parade grounds, and they used that. One day I was up at TTP, and there was a man up there with pictures of Vietnam, and so I stopped to look at them, and this man said, are you interested in this? I said, yes, I'm a World War II veteran. You get a pension? And I said, no. He said, you put in for one? I said, no, we were told we couldn't apply for pensions. He said, you come down to the Walkerville Town Hall. I'm a pension officer, he said, and we'll have a talk. And that's how I sort of got in so deeply with the ex-service down there, mainly with Vietnam vets that they didn't worry about. I mean, that because I was a little bit older, I suppose, and they were more my son's age. And he asked me a few questions. He said, you got a pay book or anything to prove that? I said, yeah, took all that down. And he put in for a pension for me, mainly for my ears to start with. No, not my ears, my wrist. My wrist was from working the spray gun, and I had that in plaster for a while. And so he put in for a pension for me for that. And with no time at all, I had 60% pension. And so I thought, well, I'm not doing anything. I'll go and take on voluntary work with them to sort of repay them. And that started the best part of my life down here. I worked with all these younger men. Their wives didn't. When the wives came, they gave me a hug the same as the men. I had all these hugs from all these younger men. And the wives became my friends. And first of all, I started making cups of tea when they came in, and when their people came from the country to have interviews, I'd give them a cup of tea, a coffee. And I gradually moved into helping in the office as well, with keeping membership book up, because it was just before TV, you know. And so, well, not before TV, before the computer. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I used to keep their membership book up, because men, if they've got a Richard Smith, they would put it in an R rather than a Smith. So I'd have to be moving those all around. And I helped read, I did the proofreading for their weekly magazine or fortnightly magazine. I just did anything that was needed extra in the office that, because they had six pension officers working plus two in the office. And so there was quite a lot of work to be done like that. And they were the ones that started laying books instead of wreaths. And so I was to cover the books ready for them to go out there. And I got to know all this crew, and it's really, although I'm an RSL member, it's still Friday lunch times, starting again soon, I hope, that I help with, and that's the Vietnam Vets luncheon. And I'm since I've got older, I've sat down now, and I sell the raffle tickets. They got to come up to me, and I screw up the raffle tickets. Hopefully I can go on with that for a little while longer. The night time the RSL down here have their meals and that at night, and I don't go out at night anymore, so I only go down the day. I'm still on the committee of the RSL. I still have a say which nobody listens to, because I'm the only World War II, I'm the only old lady there, and so they don't listen to me. I think they do, but I know that they don't. And the boys from the Vietnam Vets Association, I've sort of got to know them all over the years, and everybody down there knows me. You go down there and ask where Rena is, they'll know, they'll tell you. When you're in the services, there's a closeness between service people that you cannot explain. You ask any service person, they'll say, oh yes, there's a close, oh no, I can't explain it. But there's a closeness there. If you're ex-service, you're in. I mean, I only have to say World War II if there's somebody around, and they want to do something for you.
Can I ask you, I'm going to ask you for advice. The question is, with you currently being 99 years of age, what advice can you give to anybody about life and living a good life?
Be true to yourself, first of all. Never deliberately say something to hurt other people. If you have a different opinion than that person, which one is right? That one thinks they're right, that one thinks they're right. So instead of having a clash, say, well, look, let's sit down and talk about this, and let's try and let go halfway. Never hold a grudge against other people, because that grudge doesn't hurt the other person, but it eats away at you. In other words, just be the best person that you can to all other people, whether they're black, white, or otherwise, and just be true to yourself. When you lay your head on your pillow at night, let it be with a free conscience. If it's not free, get it free.
Rena Pascoe, thank you so much for sharing your stories and allowing me into your home here to hear them. It's been an absolute privilege to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here and reminding me of my past. It's nice to talk about my past sometimes and have somebody listen. And thank you so much for your kindness and your gentlemanness.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.